tonight's lesson, you may have gathered from the bulletin when I put out the list of sermons. It may have sort of looked as a little odd because I, for the most part, this month on Sunday evening, I've been talking about Jesus. And I've been talking about Jesus in various positions, such as the advocate, you may remember, the judge. In some respects, this lesson relates to that, although it's not why I'm preaching it. I'm really preaching it because of a couple of discussions that I had and requests I had. But it grows out of, and you're probably, you keep up with the news like I do, and you probably are well aware of all the scandals, the questions, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to delineate all of that, but things that spring to mind, for example, the IRS controversy, if you kept up with the news lately, different things like that. And it becomes, for a Christian, especially because Christians, they respect what's right, they respect fidelity in various positions and so forth. So they tend to look down upon those who are in leadership positions who don't fulfill their responsibilities. It becomes very difficult for a Christian sometimes to conscientiously maintain any level of respect for government, for those in such governmental leadership positions. And when you're just seemingly inundated, as we have been, with the shortcomings within those people, it becomes even harder. I mean, from the incompetent, and you can look at certain people, you wonder how they ever got such a job because they don't seem to be able to do it very well, to the outright corrupt, and it seems like every so often, almost, it almost seems periodically, some senator or some representative or some judge or whomever it might be is failing morally or whatever. Again, we're challenged, and we're challenged to maintain the respect that most of us at least, if not all of us, believe the Bible teaches. And I think that that's also exacerbated by a tendency in society, and we live in that time, one of the discussions that I had that this lesson grows out of, we also live in a time where it seems as though more and more morality is being attacked, more and more there is an unfair, maybe a double standard, and if you're immoral or you are involved in one of the, if I can say it like this, politically correct sins, then you seem to get away with everything. If you're not, if you're one of those who maybe opposes that kind of thing, or even if you're just a person trying, struggling to live up to the biblical standard of morality, it seems like every way you turn or every which way you turn, then there's just a growing oppression toward that. I was a little surprised also, just kind of coincidental, but I was a little surprised at the end of this past week to notice what got blown up, I think, into a big little story, if I can say it like that. But when this particular church just kind of folded, a fairly well-known anti-gay, as he was seen, pastor and leading a church or leading a religious movement or whatever, they've decided to close their doors and reopen as now swinging to the other side and being a loving, sympathetic group of people. I think that's just, again, you might say, what does that have to do with government? Again, it has to do with our whole society and where we are. And then you come back as a Christian and you realize there are just blanket statements made in the New Testament, commands that are given to us, and how we are told to view and to act, in some respects even feel, or at least conscientiously assent to various leaders, those in positions of authority, and the laws they pass. And so it becomes difficult. And perhaps you think about, in a historical context, you think about Christians that lived in Bible times, especially New Testament times, and you realize as you read of those times that our society very much reflects that time. If anything, they were worse, but increasingly not so much so. And thus it becomes, you know, you kind of look and sympathize with them. So these statements were being made, these laws, these commands were being given in the New Testament at the same time that some of you were having to go through really some of the same kinds of things. Look with me Let's just note some of the historical context, if you will, that kind of sets the tone not only for them, but also for us. Look with me at Matthew 5. I'm sure you're familiar with all these passages, but it does us good to remind ourselves of these things sometimes. In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus is teaching the Sermon on the Mount. Ben made reference to this last night, talking about the disciples and how Jesus sat on this mountain and taught them. Jesus said a number of things, again, like I said this morning in the lesson, that were unexpected. You just didn't expect to hear this from the Messiah. And as he's teaching these things, notice one of the things he says, and I hope to be able to point out in a couple of passages here how Jesus really went against the Jewish thinking, obviously because they're wrong, not just because he's trying to do that, but going against the Jewish thinking, their expectations of the Messiah, and certain things that he said. Look down at Matthew chapter 5, and you'll remember this is in the paragraph that starts, "You've heard it's been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." They really expected the Messiah to be a vengeful Messiah. They expected him to be one who would give back to the Romans everything that had been given to them. And yet, in the midst of these laws like turn the other cheek, if you'll notice down in verse 41, very interesting and almost strange out of place statement. "Whosoever shall compel you, force you to go a mile," or literally in the a word that means in the original, I think it was 1,000 paces, if I'm thinking right. And don't quote me on that because I might be wrong. But anyway, this certain distance. "Anyone that compels you to go to a mile, go with him twain," or "go double." And you have to understand that this was, and maybe I should kind of detract and just make this point because I think it really has some impact. The Romans were collectors. They were known for basically being the kind of people that collected the best of every society. They took the Greek gods, for example, because they considered them the best idols around. And they renamed them and made them their own. So Zeus became Jupiter, etc. They took the Persian form of punishment because they considered it the cruelest and the best. And so they crucified people. That wasn't a Roman invention. It was a Persian invention. Well, another Persian invention was putting people in their place with certain little laws. The kind of laws that would just kind of jab you and remind you every day, this is who you are, and this is not what you are. And one of those laws is verse 41. A Roman law said that a Roman, if he had need of you, could just call you out of whatever you're doing and say, "Carry my baggage," or "Carry my load," or whatever it might be. I think it's 1,000 paces, or a mile. And it put you in your place. It reminded you that you were not equal. It said to you at any time, day or night, "I will remind you, and I can remind you, I have the right to remind you that you are a conquered people and you stay in your place." Now, they hated that. And so one of the things, and we look back and we read about expectations and so forth, one of the things that they expected was this strong conquering hero that would come along and say, "Jews, you're not going to be put down like this anymore. You're going to fight, you're going to win. God is on your side." So it goes totally against that for someone to say, if they force you to go a mile, go twice, as far as they tell you you have to. And yet, that's the context, that's the time in which Jesus would speak laws like this. Another one, turn a few pages over to Matthew 22. And we realize in Matthew 22 that they're testing Jesus. The context tells us that. But I want you to notice something interesting here in Matthew 22. Look down in the context in verse 16 and notice they came to him and this is what they said. And I think verse 16 is important. Again, they're trying in verse 15 to entangle him or trap him in what he says. But they said, "Master, we know you're true and we know you teach the way of God in truth." Now, whether they're being sincere or not, you don't know. I tend to think they're not. But they said, "We know you teach the way of God in truth. We also know you don't care for any man. You don't have particular respect for any person, no matter who they are. And you regard not the person of men." In other words, You don't care if someone is a Roman or not. So we got to ask you a question. What about this paying taxes business? And they asked him. Jesus, remember, he discusses this with them and finally comes to the point of saying, if you look in verse 21, whose superscription is on the coin? Caesar's. He comes to the point in verse 21 of saying, render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things which are God's. Unless you understand the historical concept of the Messiah and the context in which this is written, you really don't grasp what he's saying and how offended they would have been by that. You're telling us that you're the Messiah. You're telling us that you're the Christ. And yet you're telling us to do honor to Caesar, obey Caesar, and pay the taxes to him. And you're not supposed to be someone who regards men or the person of men or all of that kind of thing. Now, I don't believe that that's true in verse 16. I think from a strict point, at best, they're twisting the idea of God as no respecter of persons. But I think what they're really doing is being dishonest here. I believe Jesus would have shown respect, and we can see that, for those in positions of authority. Yes, he clearly teaches the truth about them. And we'll look at one of those passages in a minute. But it's not as though he disrespects them and boasts. You know, as I asked the question on the bulletin this morning, did Jesus go around boasting who he was and sort of claiming his rights? We don't see him doing that. I don't have to respect you. I don't have to obey you. I'm the Son of God. I made you. We don't ever see him doing that kind of thing. And then finally, the whole book of Revelation, turn there if you want to, but just think in terms of the book of Revelation. You have a Roman government, at least that's what I believe the book is about, things that are shortly to come to pass, verse 1 and 3 there, near at hand. You've got a Roman government, it's very oppressive. By the 90s, the time I believe the book is written, of the first century, the 80-90s, that you've got a very oppressive government that is in its second wave of intense persecution, Nero having been the first, and then coming along in the 90s, those couple of emperors. And oppressing Christians so hard, so much so that they cry out to God. You see that very graphically when you turn to Revelation 6. How long, God? How long will you not avenge us? How long will you let this go on? And yet it's in that context, it's in that historical context that we know and we understand, and you know all the stories about Christians being thrown to the lions. That's very popular. It's even entered pop culture. You know, the idea of Christians being burned on lampposts and everything else. And yet it's in that context that God makes some of these blanket statements. Well, what kinds of statements? Well, first of all, look with me at John 19. I said Jesus didn't boast. And Jesus didn't claim he wasn't responsible to obey authorities, those in position. And again, I'm not going to really develop this point. But think in terms, for example, when Jesus might heal a leper and say, go to the priest. Because that's in obedience to the law. And even though the priests were corrupt at the time, he's still sending people to them in obedience to the law. But again, look here in John, and we look at chapter 19, and you remember this very well, I'm sure. But this is when Jesus goes before Pilate. Pilate has a series of questions. And finally, Pilate wants to know, where did you come from? And if you look down in this, in John 19, I'm going to jump in the middle of it. Pilate is asking him, whence art thou, verse 9, or where do you come from? And Jesus gave no answer. And Pilate, in verse 10, basically, I guess we would say, he's had enough. Enough of this not answering. So he said to him, do you not speak to me? And I don't know what tone of voice he said it in or anything else, but the question is valid. I am the Roman appointed official. You are on trial, or at least what we might consider an inquest today, and I have the right to ask you questions, and you're not speaking to me, you're not answering me. And Jesus makes the point here, not, I don't believe in a disrespectful way of saying, that's right, buddy, I'm not answering you, and you're not going to ask me any questions, but I believe Jesus takes the occasion to teach the point. And you look at verse 10, Pilate says, do you not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to crucify you? And I have authority to release you.
And Jesus answered that and said, you could have no authority against me at all. Now you'll notice, he's not saying you don't have it. In fact, he's agreeing you do. But he's saying you could have no authority at all against me except it were given to you from above. And therefore, he that delivered me unto you has the greater sin. What is Jesus getting at here? We know what he's saying. He's plainly declaring that the authority that rests in government officials comes from God. But what's the lesson to us? The lesson to us is that even as Christians, even when we're on trial, perhaps even when we're unjustly accused, etc., we are still in a position to submit to those in authority. And the ultimate reason Pilate is saying here, do you not know that I have authority? Think about the way Pilate would have thought. He would have reasoned. I'm in authority because Caesar gives me authority. I'm in authority because Rome gives me the authority. I'm in authority, I'm in power because the greatest nation and the greatest force on earth, as he would have seen it, gives me the authority. Jesus said, no. You are in authority ultimately because God gives you authority. And that's why he submits. You remember in this passage that Jesus doesn't rebel against him. He doesn't, scream for a revolt. He doesn't ask for his servants to, rise up in a revolution and free him. In fact, he even goes so far as to say, if my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight. But that's not what we're about. One of the things that we as Christians, as disciples, as servants of God, one of the things we're about is obeying those in authority. And the reason we obey them is not because they're powerful or what they can do to us. Of course, I don't want to go to jail. And I don't want the consequences of breaking the law. I do care about that. The older I get, the more I care about that, But I don't want to suffer those consequences. But ultimately, the reason I obey the law of man is because God has given them their authority. There may come a time, and we'll talk about that, we'll mention that, but there may come a time when we have to disobey the law of God. And we're close, When I say that, I used to say that, and it was almost like, probably never in my lifetime, but I don't know anymore. We're close. And there could be some very simple things. We are very, very close. Laws are right now entered. Bills are entered and have been before and defeated. But who knows now? It may be that someone will send us a letter. Just a simple little governmental letter and tell us or announce it that the law has been passed. There are certain things you can't teach at East Orange Church of Christ. Certain laws of God, they won't say it like that. But certain things that you believe that are no longer legal to be publicly taught. What will we do? Will we violate the law? Will we give in to the law? Even though they're telling us that you can't teach the Word of God, what will we do? There may come a time when it comes to that. But as Christians, our position, our first thought always is just like Jesus, render unto Caesar what belongs to Caesar. Obey the laws. When Pilate says, I have authority. Jesus is really saying here in this passage, look at it again. You're right, Pilate. You do have authority. And God gave it to you. So let's look at this for a moment. And this won't be anything difficult. But let's go back to the Old Testament and just see how the precedent really was established in the Old Testament. I'm going to turn to 2 Samuel chapter 6 here. And this is when David is making a statement to his wife, I believe, in this passage. But he's making a statement here in 2 Samuel about his position. How Saul and Saul's descendants were removed by God. And you remember that happened over the Amalekites or Amalekites. But in 2 Samuel 6, and if you'll drop down, I'll just pick out one verse here. Down in verse 21. Wrong chapter. There we go. Chapter 21, or chapter 6, verse 21. Notice how David said to Michal or Michal, it was before the Lord which chose me before your father. He says, remember, she's Saul's daughter. And before all his house, that is his descendants who would have, in the way of things, taken the throne. And before all his house to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord, over Israel. God makes the appointment. He had said something similar back in 1 Samuel, I think it's chapter 25. But nonetheless, making that point. Look back all the way, if you will, to Deuteronomy chapter 1. And we go back that far even. And how God is saying here, and I'll drop down again, just pick out one verse that makes the point. But Deuteronomy 1, and look down in verse 13. When God says to Moses here, He says, take you wise men and understanding and known among your tribes, and I will make them rulers over you. And I think that's interesting. If you think about it, and I'm not sure this is emphasized enough today. We studied this morning downstairs in the first principles class. We were talking about elders. In fact, we were talking about pastors, and we were making the difference down there. Preachers are not pastors. That's a completely different role or function or office in the New Testament. And you know, the whole denominational idea of pastors and all of that, it takes some teaching to show the difference. But one of the things that we were showing down there and we were talking about was Acts 20 and verse 28. And if you remember what Paul said, even to the elders of Ephesus, he said, feed or shepherd the flock of God over the which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. I hear members of the church, we don't have a lot of elders today. We don't have a lot of men serving in that position. But I hear members of the church talking about the church appointing elders. Well, it does. But you have to understand that while the church may look out among them, just like he's telling Moses to do here, and the church may appoint elders, the truth is they are really appointed into that position, put into that office, if you will, by God. And it's very, very clearly said there in Acts 20 and verse 28, just like God is saying here to Moses, I'll put you in a position of leadership, but I will do that. Look over with me, if you will, at the book of Daniel. And I think it's very stark here. When I was doing this sermon or preparing it, I was thinking about a lesson that Wes taught. Did a really good job in going through these verses. But again, just remind yourself of how many times God makes the point in the book of Daniel of how the king got to be the king. Of course, he's saying all of this to Nebuchadnezzar. Look at chapter 2 and look down at verse 37 when Daniel interprets his vision. You, O king, are a king of kings. Notice again, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. Later in chapter 4, turn a couple of pages over, when Nebuchadnezzar was lifted up with pride, you know, and goes out and looks at everything that he's done, all of this that I've accomplished. And Daniel had reminded him, don't get carried away in your pride, because God can bring you down. He sets you up. He can pull you down. Look down in verse 25. They that shall drive thee from men and thy dwelling shall be in the beast of the field, and you will make they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen. They shall wet thee with the dew of heaven. Seven times will pass over you. He's warning him here. Till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever he will. Pilate, you wouldn't have your authority if it hadn't been given you from above. Notice how many times this is reiterated in this passage. Look down at verse 34. He does lift up with pride, and God does strike him down. And at the end of those seven times, or the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven. My understanding returned unto me. And I blessed the Most High, he says. And I praised and honored him that lives forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom from generation to generation. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. And he does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. So it's not just that God's realm is up there and man's realm is down here. He's very much active in the affairs of men. None can stay his hand or say unto him, what are you doing? Look at verse 37. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven. All whose works are truth, and his way is just, our judgment. And those that walk in pride, he is able to abase. So you understand that Nebuchadnezzar realized, and we realize, it is God who's in control. It's easy to forget. And you listen to the comments that people are making, and maybe some of the concerns they have, and I think rightly so. I've heard, I suppose, more concern for this nation, the direction it's going. And that's not, you know, just to talk about one person in one office, but I mean as a whole, just across the board, where people are, where leaders are, where the nation is moving as a whole, people are very concerned. Righteous people are very concerned. And then there creeps in all of that, why does God allow this to happen? Why doesn't God do something? Well, God has a timetable. God always has one. And it generally, if not always, runs differently to ours. There's a lot of lenience. There's a lot of leeway to repent. There's a lot of allowing us, if we will, to be righteous in an unrighteous nation. But God certainly is in control. And these passages are teaching that. Now we come to the New Testament. Look with me at Romans 13. I know you know this passage well, but remember what is said here. And sometimes I go back and I read this when I haven't read it, you know, in a while. I go back and I read it carefully and I listen again to what God is saying. And I realize, don't get all upset, all carried away. Let God be God and deal with it. And God can. Read these verses with me. When he starts in verse 1, actually this begins, and I'm not going to take the time to do that, but go back to chapter 12 and realize that starting in verse 19, he is actually talking about Christians not taking vengeance. And basically what he is saying here is, there's a group that's been appointed by God to take it for you. God takes the vengeance. He repays. And in fact, start with me in verse 1, and we see one of the ways, at least in a temporal sense, that God exacts his vengeance. He says, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers. For there is no power or authority but of God. The authorities are the powers that be. They are ordained or appointed by God. Whosoever therefore resists the power, this is the idea of rebels against it literally. Whoso resists the power resists the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves condemnation. Rulers are not a terror to good or to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power, or again, the authority? Do that which is good, and you shall have praise of the same. For he, still speaking of government, still speaking of the authority established by God, for he is the minister, the servant of God, to you for good. But if you do that which is evil, be afraid. He bears not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God. He is a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Now a person reads that and says, okay, well, as long as they're doing what they're supposed to do, you know, then I'm willing to submit to them. Again, remember, this is written after the very terrible reigns, I mean horrible reigns, of Caligula and Claudius. And this is written right before, and I'm sure God knows that, right before the extremely horrible reign of Nero. You realize when these people got this letter, it would not have been even 10 years old, and probably closer to 5, when Nero started all that garbage. And these people would have had this letter fresh. And this passage would have been, I'm sure, in their minds. And they would have thought, now wait a minute. You're saying, wherefore, verse 5, you must needs be subject? I have to submit to some crazy guy like Caligula? And you can go home and read about Caligula yourself. I mean, it's filthy. It's vile. He's a horrible person, human being, and he was a horrible leader. I have to submit to somebody like that? Yeah, it's exactly what God is saying. You must needs, you have to be subject. Not only for wrath, notice, but also for conscience sake. What conscience? About what? Well, I think if you look in this context, conscience about the fact that he's appointed by God. Conscience about the fact that he's in office, just like Jesus said to Pilate, you would have no authority except it were given to you from above. And let God deal with it. So my position as a Christian, blanket statement. Notice, not if he's good, not if he's bad, not if you agree with him, not if you don't. You know, we do have, by law in this country, We have the ability to redress our grievances. If we disagree with laws, we can, as a people, say we disagree with them. That's our law. And so we obey it. We, as a law, by law, as a people, can vote people in and out of office. But what happens when you have that much freedom is you go the next step and you begin then to say, I can choose who I respect. I can choose who I obey. I can choose what laws I obey. And that's not what God has said. You must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but for conscience sake, for this cause. And I'll paraphrase at this point, obey the laws. Notice as you go on and look at 1 Peter chapter 2. Now, this is what Bill read for us a moment ago. Let's notice how, again, Peter says it here. I'm going to go back and forth. Hold your finger at Romans 13, 1 Peter 2. I'm going to go back and forth for a moment here. Look at 1 Peter 2 and notice again, verse 13. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. Now, this is in a context where, basically, if you notice back in verse 11, Peter is talking about how different Christians are. Christians live different lives. There are speed limit laws. I don't like them. A lot of times. And back when there were 55 out on the interstate, I hated them. You know, I mean, it's a lot better now. But 70 is still not 90 or 95 if I'm in a big hurry. Seatbelt laws. I loathe wearing a seatbelt. You probably don't know anyone that hates it worse than I do. Still do. Been wearing one because it's been a law in Alabama for 15 years now. So I started wearing one back in the mid-90s. And I started wearing it exactly on the day the law said you've got to wear it. Because I hate it. I still do. But that's the law. Why do Christians do that? Well, for a number of reasons. You see the sense in it, you don't see the sense in it. You like it, you don't like it. Why do Christians do it? Christians do it because they obey the law. And they obey the law, really, no matter what, with one exception. We've mentioned it, we'll mention it again in a moment. But you're different. I beseech you, verse 11. I beg you, Christians, as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lust. You probably read that just like I do. First thing that comes to your mind, you know, desires, sexual desires, and all kinds of, you know, the pleasures and all of that kind of thing. But, you know, you can have desires about what laws you want to obey or you don't. You can have desires about all kinds of things. And you'll notice as he goes on here, having your life or your manner of life or your conversation honest, honorable among the Gentiles. They're going to speak against you as evildoers. They're going to find fault with you. But you, one of the things you do, verse 13, it stands out. People see it. You submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. And you notice again how he's saying that. Why do we obey? Why do we submit to those in government? Even terrible, horrible leaders. And I dare say, at least my opinion, take it for what it's worth. I don't know how many presidents we've seen that would have ranked up there with Caligula. Again, go home and read about it. Doesn't matter. Submit for the Lord's sake. And you notice he goes on just as the passage was read, Bill read the passage. Notice again in Titus 3, very similar here. And you'll note how he says it in Titus 3, verse 1. Again, of Christians. Of those who have received this grace of salvation that teaches us things. Chapter 2. And then he says this in verse 1 of chapter 3. Put them in mind to be subject to principalities and powers to obey magistrates. Let me retranslate that, so to speak. Put them in mind, literally, is what it says. To be subject, to submit themselves to rulers and authorities. All rulers, all authorities, and to obey, and now notice this, to obey their rulings. You know what that's saying to me as a Christian? That's saying, first of all, recognize who they are. Recognize the position they're in, and then do what they say. Because of who they are. The practical import of that, really, when you look in the New Testament, it's very clear. And There are different passages that say that. But I think it comes down in a very general sense. You may notice on your outline, I said, recognize their authority, obey, submit. These are terms that keep coming up. And if you notice, I said, it's not up to whether or not I choose to obey. God isn't saying that. I must obey, simply. And I put down here a parallel. I want you to really think about this for a moment. Statement, you know, and someone might make this statement. Maybe two young people are talking. One young person wants another young person to do something, go somewhere, whatever it might be. And the other young person responds and says, no, my parents won't let me. And maybe the other one is encouraging, I would have been that one, encouraging the person to disobey their parents and just do it anyway. And someone might answer back, and I had a friend, and he had a very strong family, and there were a lot of times when he'd look back at me and say, they're my parents, I have to obey them. And you know, that's exactly right. They're my parents. God put them in that position. I'm their child. He put me in the position to obey. Now, I realize you get older and you become an adult and you make your decision, all of that. I'm talking about children. Small, younger children. They're your parents. You have to obey. Well, in a very parallel sense, they're the authorities. You have to obey. As we say down south, or a lot of people do, they're the law. The law. And that's the way it's all summed up. And maybe it's not a bad way to sum it up. They're the law. I have to obey. And what it's saying is, you have to maintain that level of respect for the position that person is in. Honor your father and mother. Blanket statement the Bible makes. Again, honor those in a position of authority. And the Bible teaches that, doesn't it? Look back with me at Romans 13 again. We go back to this passage and we see that. What he says in Romans 13, in fact in 1 Peter 2, we're going to go to both passages. But notice the terms that are used. Here in Romans 13, look down in verses 6 and 7. Remember he had talked about all of that. You have to be subject to them for who they are, for conscience sake. Then he says verse 6, for this cause... And he begins to be practical about it. What does it mean? What are you telling us we have to do? Pay your taxes. What taxes? All of them. You know, you got to pay your taxes. I ask a question. You may see it down here on the second page near the end of the outline. Under letter C, and I said, do you like to pay taxes? If you say no, and that's what first comes to your mind, no, I don't like to pay taxes. Big chunk out of the paycheck, don't like to pay taxes. You'd be like a lot of people. But then you begin to think about it, and so I ask this question, do you enjoy or do you ever benefit from what is done with the taxes? You know, yeah, there's a lot of waste, tremendous amount of waste. It's debated all the time right now. I heard someone else, again with a whole lot of people, say the other day, if the government is wasting this much money on this kind of thing, why do I have to pay my taxes? Well, because they're the government. And because God says pay your taxes. But you know, the truth is, I don't know if you stop to think about it. Sometimes I do, but I confess a lot of times I don't. But when I drive over a bridge that I realize may be an old bridge and we have all kinds of problems, but still, I'm glad the bridge is built. How long would it take me if I was going to Alabama and I had to cross a river to do what they had to do a couple hundred years ago? Chop down a bunch of trees, build me a raft, put my car on it, float it across the river, get to the other side, leave it for the next person that might be going the opposite direction, and then go on to Alabama. I'm glad there are bridges. I'm glad there are roads and bridges, and on we go. And I'm glad that someone has the foresight to build those things, and I realize it takes a tremendous amount of money, and part of the taxes I pay go for those kinds of things. So yeah, there's all the waste. And God knew that when he wrote this in Romans 13. I mean, do you understand that historically, what Paul was basically saying is pay for your own oppression and persecution. Yeah. But government is there for your benefit, Romans 13. And we're going to talk about it in a moment when they don't benefit you. But they're there for your benefit. They are supposed to benefit you. And that's what you're paying. So, honor to whom honor. Fear to whom fear. And if you look here at Romans 13, verse 7, tribute or taxes to whom taxes, and again we might say, and specific taxes to whom specific taxes are due. Because these were two different terms, and it was used just to cover a wide range of taxes, property taxes, and on it went, just like we have today. What is God saying here? Pay your taxes. All your taxes. Fear, respect, honor. It's the idea of, literally, in this word for honor, fix an assigned value. Recognize the position and respect the position. If you can't respect a man, fine. I'm not sure that, and well, I really am. I don't think God was ever saying here, pick out a Caligula and respect him for the human being he is. He's not saying that. He's saying respect the position. Honor, 1 Peter 2, the king. It's the position. Pay your taxes. Notice how in both passages here, and again in Titus 3, we read it already, submit to every ordinance, every law, not the laws you agree with. I like the helmet law. I hate the seatbelt law. That's not my job to pick and choose. The laws are the laws. I like paying taxes, this kind of tax, but I hate paying this kind of tax, so I don't. That's not your choice. And then finally, and I'll mention this and I'll turn to it, but pray for them. That's your job as a Christian. And pray that the right people are in office. And that leads us back to Romans 13. Now, I want you to read this together with me again. A warning to government. Ours in America and every other government. You're put there for a reason. God is very specific. Some people might look at this and say, man, this is ridiculous. Maybe people would. We should never. God puts them in power. And if you'll notice here, verse 2, we'll start with it. Whosoever therefore resists the power, resists the ordinance or appointment of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves condemnation. For rulers, those in authority, are not a terror to good works. Now let's stop there for a minute. Is it a good work, for example? Is it a good work if we open up our Bibles, we run across Leviticus 19 or whatever passage, and we teach against homosexuality? Is that a good work? It is. And government should be in support of the freedom to do that. Now suppose we reach a point, laws that are literally on the table right now, where we can be closed down. If we say, we're still going to teach, they say, no, you can't. You can never say that. You can never reject anyone who tells you they're practicing homosexual. You can never teach against it. What do we do? What does someone like me do if someone says, if you teach that publicly, you go to jail? If anyone, you know, sues you for harassment or whatever it might be, you can go to jail. What do I do? Well, my job is to obey God rather than men. But you look here at Romans 13, a word of warning. You are in a position as the government to be a terror to evil works, not to good. You are in a position as a government to praise, look at verse 30, those who do what's right, not to condemn them, not to talk about how they are, you know, whatever, all the terms that are used to talk about people that are, you know, insensitive, and on and on and on it goes. He's a servant of God, verse 4, to you. You understand? God looks at government. That's what Romans 13 is saying. God looks at government as being in a position to benefit Christians. Now, that doesn't mean government comes in here and helps us raise money and all of that. It means, though, that we have the freedom to teach and preach in the name of Jesus. And when a government says, no, you don't have that right, or the government wants to begin to pick and choose what part of it we can, well, you can preach the love, everybody, but you can't preach, you have to do this or you have to do that. God says, wait a minute. That's not your position. That's not what you're there for. He bears not the sword in vain. He's a minister of God. He is supposed to be a servant of God to execute wrath, notice verse 4, on the one that does evil, not good. And so you as a Christian, you realize that when government gets out of order, when it's upside down in a society, it was in the first century, second century, when it gets upside down and government begins to persecute the good and reward the evil, God is going to get involved. That's why Revelation is written. To say, no, I understand. I take complete notice of what's going on in the government of Rome, and I'm going to deal with it. And that government went down. And in fact, the Bible warns every government. You know, passages like Proverbs 14, verse 34, it is righteousness that exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. And we see examples of governments and nations in the Bible, really many of them, who got upside down, where good was terrorized and evil was rewarded. And God dealt with those nations. Does He do it immediately? Zap them out of existence at the first sign? No, never. He gives them time, just like Abraham. No, you can't occupy Canaan and have it till the fourth generation because the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. Sometimes I wonder if in heaven God is saying the iniquity of the United States is not yet full, but it's on its way. I don't know. I'm not trying to be a prophet about it, but it's a word of warning to Christians. Bottom line, what does it say? You do what you're supposed to do. You obey God, and you obey the laws of man. And you let God take care of it. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, if you believe in Jesus, that He is the Son of God, that He is the one in absolute control, and you're willing to give your life to Him as the Lord, as the King, if tonight you'll be baptized for forgiveness of your sins, the Lord will wash them away. Maybe you're here tonight and there's something in your life that isn't right. You want to turn from that. You want to be right with God. And you certainly have the opportunity, just like we saw our members here, some of them this morning, ask for the prayers of the people. You need to come.